Welcome to Strong Tower Radio. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, and we're talking with the nature guy, Dr. Gordon Atkins from Camp Asabo in Grayling, Michigan. We're doing the migration series. We did it this spring. It was a wonderful adventure. We've learned so much, and now we're doing the fall migration of birds and fish. And that'll be our next edition. But to look forward, welcome, Nature Guy.
Well, thank you for having me. It's good to be here again.
Great. Let's have a word of prayer and give thanks to our Heavenly Father that we can study such a wonderful, marvelous event. Our great Heavenly Father, we want to thank you that you have created down to the nth detail, to the cells and to the structure of animals, fish, and birds, and butterflies, and others, and humans. Dear Lord, help us to look at this and marvel and give you the glory in Jesus' name. Amen. Dr. Atkins, let's talk about the fall migration. What define a fall migration? Now, in the spring, I learned that it's more broad. There's early, maybe even mid and late migrations. Did I get that right? That's correct.
Okay, good.
And we need to put this into a series and put it on our website for posterity.
Sure.
And but the fall, you told me that it's more concentrated. It's not as well defined. Can you follow up with that?
Yeah. So depending on the species, in the spring, there's very defined times that different groups go, and in the fall, there's sort of general trends, but it's much looser. It's maybe a little more dependent on the weather. Whereas in the spring, they're desperate to get up to their breeding grounds on time, and being first is important. Returning back to wintering grounds, there's not that same urgency, so it takes longer. It's not as synchronous and so forth.
So you can't go to your calendar and say today we're going to see such and such outside the window.
Correct, but it is surprising that certain birds come early and some come a little later, and the ducks pick up the tail end of things into November. So the fall migration season really kind of extends from even as early as August with the shorebirds until November with the ducks and warblers and other songbirds in between. But there's a great deal of overlap. You're right. It's not as predictable to the almost day and hour as it is in the spring.
I appreciate that. We talked about the winds. Any more details on that?
Well, wind is really important because, the birds are up there flying, and if there's a strong wind from the side, that can blow them off course. So birds just tend to not migrate. If they have a choice, they'll just not migrate on really windy days.
So it's just not a good day. Let's not do it.
Right. There's a lot more effort to fly into the wind and more chance of getting blown off course, depending on what cues they're using. If they're following the shoreline and they can see the shoreline, then I guess it doesn't matter that the wind is blowing. But if it's a cloudy day, they're up high enough, they can't see the shoreline, then that's going to become an issue. So they tend to avoid bad weather because it's just easier and less likely to create a problem.
How serious is it to be off course?
That depends on who you are.
Okay.
Some birds leave very specific locations and go to very specific locations, and if they're off course, they're not.
They missed it.
For example, if you're a Kirtland's warbler from just up here down the road, you want to get to the Bahamas, and if you get blown off course very far, you miss the island, you land somewhere else, and the habitat's different, and your home base isn't there, and there's a real advantage of knowing the area that you're going to or living in, because you know where the predators are. It just works better when the bird knows where he's at. And then one of the other things too is the time of day. Certain groups of birds migrate more in the day and some more at night. And we talked about this a bit. The birds of prey, the hawks and eagles, you're more likely to see those in the daytime traveling because they use the thermals, which are sort of the rising
air currents.
The sun has to be out to create the heat currents to lift the birds. So they're not having to flap as much. They can just glide.
So at night, the temperatures are more stable and
yes,
not so much
you don't have the uplift. And so the birds of prey choose to go when it's easier during the daytime. And they're big, and we can see in the daytime. So that's quite a spectacular part of fall migration. You get these big, what we call kettles, these big swirling masses, sometimes hundreds of hawks in a single kettle.
So what does it look like for this year, the daytime?
Again, it depends where you are. We've had some really extremes this year in very, very hot temperatures and as we're recording, we're having really quite warm in the Midwest. So that might actually get some of the birds moving earlier because it's fairly warm even into the beginning of the season. But it'll really depend on what the weather's like more in September.
Okay.
It might be a little earlier than normal just based on the weather so far.
So let's talk about the nighttime flyers.
So many of the smaller birds use the nighttime because there's fewer predators, and they often travel in mixed flocks. So all the small birds get together, all the warblers, for example, or sparrows might be in mixed flocks, and they take advantage of the calmer winds at night and fewer predators out and about.
Why is there less predators? Because the hawks and the birds of prey are daytime.
That's right.
There's a connection.
Yeah. So the predators migrate in the day. So hey, we'll go at night.
At night. Okay. Gotcha. It's kind of like some people drive at night because there's less
traffic.
Yeah.
So if they're traveling at night, obviously visual cues aren't as great, at least the things that we consider visual cues, but they do use the star map. So if it's clear at night, they can use the star. Some of them use the position of the moon, but many of them use a magnetic compass. Mm. And that's another whole topic someday, but they have a magnetic compass in their head and they can use that information kind of like we'd use a GPS to get where we're going. And then some navigation, you're going to a specific location so that if you get blown off track, that's a bigger problem. Some navigation is done by direction. So you want to go, south 15 degrees west or something. And so some birds are able to compensate for the change with winds and so forth, and others aren't. They get horribly lost, but others can make up the difference. Either a calculation while they're flying based on their measurement of wing speed and doing some fancy calculus that I couldn't do, that they figure how to adjust the schedule. But it just depends on each species, what the kind of navigation they're using.
Okay, what about the behavior adaptations that these various birds, I'm sure it changes just across the species.
Sure, so any given species, there's usually some changes that take place in the fall as they prepare for migration. And most of that is related to energy consumption. As you can imagine, flying south is not a trivial event. For a lot of birds, there's a buildup of fat tissue.
Mm, okay.
So someone who is a bird bander and knows birds in the hand very well, they actually have measurements of how much fat tissue. The skin is so thin that you can actually push the feathers apart and see the fat stores under the skin, and they have a numerical rating system of how fat they are.
Are they little globs of fat?
Or yeah, little yellowish and brownish globs of fat you can see through the skin, and they, based on the percentage of the skin area covered by fat, they have a sort of a scoring system. So someone who really knows what they're talking about knows whether this bird has just flown or is about to fly based on how much fat tissue they have.
How much fat's left in the tissue.
Right, right. And then there are also changes that you can't see, but changes in the physiology of the muscle, so that the muscles are more efficient at breaking down energy. More of the organelles that are involved in energy metabolism, they increase. So the muscles are just better at doing their job, but it takes more energy. So those two things have to go together.
They have more muscle tone?
Not so much tone, but the ability to convert fat energy into movement.
Okay.
And so the actual mechanical part is much more efficient. And then, of course, there's, you know, the whole navigation thing we've talked about. Some of these navigational features only turn on when the day length is right. So, you know, there may be a very smart bird able to do the calculation to fly south. But if you ask that bird to do it in the summertime, they wouldn't have a clue what you're talking about.
Wow.
So different parts of the brain light up in different seasons based on day length. So as fall comes, things are happening inside the bird. I don't know if they realize it or feel it or not, but things are changing, all focused on making it more likely that they can use the energy to get where they need to go.
I coined a phrase while we were sitting here, navigational acuity.
Yes, and what it turns out to be is birds don't usually just rely on one thing. They've got several things going on, and they kind of take all that. I suppose it's like us. You know, we have the GPS going, we have a map, we have our memory, and we rely on, you know, different parts of our system.
If two of the three agree.
yeah, something like, hey, this doesn't look right, then you start going back and figuring it out. So that's much similar to what they do. But they also travel in groups, and they communicate while they're migrating. It's kind of it's not a loud thing, but if you go in the middle of the night on a clear day with no wind, you can actually hear the flocks of bird going over. It's kind of more of a twittering sound, because they're communicating with each other and sharing, like, I think it's this way, I think it's that way. And, you know, if there's 400 saying it's this way and there's only two saying it's that way, well, the group goes with the majority. So it's very much a group effort in addition to sort of an individual using several options at its disposal. And then, of course, experience plays into this too. So the birds that have done this before will follow, you know, young birds will follow those that have the experience.
So I'm sure that across the spectrum, there's different, what's the lifespan of an average bird? And that's probably completely across the board.
So small birds, it depends on the size. Small birds, like the little songbirds we're talking about, 4 or 5 years is a pretty good length of life. Larger birds like gulls, for example, can live to be 25 years. Mm-hmm. And hawks and eagles, some of them can live beyond 50 years.
Let's talk about their plumage and their camouflage. How does that change?
So in addition to sort of these physiological changes that are taking place to help make migration work better, birds go through various numbers of molts, and again, it depends on the species, but they'll maybe have a spring plumage and a fall plumage, or what birders really refer to as a breeding plumage and a non-breeding plumage. But of course, around here, breeding means spring, so you can interchange those. But the fall colors, the fall plumage, is not anything as striking as the breeding plumage. There's no one to impress. So all the bright colors and patterns and songs aren't there. So they're a quieter bird, and they're more subdued in colors. So something that might be like a Blackburnian warbler that's orange and black and white, it's going to be still striped, and maybe you recognize the face patterns, but it's not bright orange. It's kind of a dull, they're all dull, greenish, grayish, yellowish.
I think that is traveling clothes.
And so in fall, again, they're all traveling in groups. So you may encounter a wave of warblers moving through the treetops going through your yard. And I had this happen just a couple of days ago. There were 7 species in the flock, but boy, they all were pretty similar.
Like generic.
It was easy to pick out the Nashville warbler because it doesn't have many stripes, but all the other ones are striped greenish gray with a little wash of yellow.
Yeah.
And in the springtime, they'd be spectacularly different. So a lot of birders just ignore fall migrations.
They pass,
because it is more difficult. But then there are others that, wow, this is a real challenge. Like, it's easy in spring. Let's see what we can figure out. So it is a fun time, but it is not as spectacular.
Let's talk about the Michigan fall migration. Who flies or what happens?
Yeah, so a good question is, do they just fly over Michigan or do they stop over and rest and feed? And the answer is both. But Michigan is a crucial stopover location for many birds during the fall. Michigan has a diverse number of habitats. So, just about any bird could find some place in Michigan that it sort of recognizes that would have a food source. The main thing is shelter from storms and a food source to refuel, because they tend not to go the whole way in one shot. So they'll come, a few hundred miles and then stop and rest. And the stopovers can be several weeks.
Wow.
As they, build up reserves and then go on. Some birds, it might just be an overnight thing. But they can stop and rest and recuperate and get ready for the next leg of the journey. So if you do find one of those spots with lots of birds looking for food and resting, it can be pretty spectacular. The geography of Michigan also plays into this, because, we're surrounded by water. So birds going north to south, both coastlines along Lake Michigan and along Lake Huron are good visual cues for falling, particularly if you're water birds or the birds of prey. Maybe not so much the little birds that are flying at night and using other cues, but the daytime flying birds, those shorelines are really very helpful. I mean, pretty obvious. And a lot of birds don't like to fly out over open water for obvious reasons.
Very many places that land.
Right. So they tend to funnel down the shoreline. So east and west coasts of Michigan can be pretty spectacular, whether the bird's flying through or staying. Those are good places to encounter birds in the fall.
I was just thinking about those who stay for a period of time, and you said they had to fuel up, they had to get food. Are they pretty exhausted? How far north are they coming from? I mean, what percentage of their journey have they made?
Yeah, it depends. Some birds
go way up there.
Some birds just go to the UP to breed, and others go all the way up to above the Arctic Circle in the tundra. So it really depends on the species. And some are going a long way, and Michigan is just part way. For some species, Michigan might be getting close to where they're going to stop, middle of the states where there's not too much snow and they can survive it. They'll only go that far. They really only go as far as they need to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so, some birds have come thousands of miles and are going thousands more. So it can be a very important stopover point.
Okay, where can we go to see this? I remember in the spring migration, it was really, I think you gave us several great tips. And what do we have for fall? Are they the same places?
Some can be, but often it's different places.
Why would that be?
Because they're sort of different strategies. Again, in the spring, they're eager to get up there. They're going to stop at a key location and be on the move right away.
They're pretty picky. Yeah.
They're very driven to get to their destination. Whereas in the fall, they've got time. They've got no rush to get to where they're
like
going to.
The difference between spring break with the family that has 1 week and the retirees that are going to Florida for the winter, they'll get there when they get there.
They don't have a schedule. That's a good comparison. So in Michigan, of course, the shorelines that we were just talking about, if that's what they're using. So Tawas Point State Park is a really, really great place.
So we're on the
east
side. How far?
On the east side.
It's above the thumb, correct?
It's part way up, I suppose, maybe halfway up as the bird sees it on the map of the lake. But because of the long peninsula that extends south, birds migrating down the shoreline kind of accumulate at that point before they jump off and fly across Tawas Bay. So it can, especially if there's a storm brewing, they'll all kind of tend to accumulate at that spot and wait for their time to go. Again, maybe they're hard to identify, but there could be a lot of birds there at one time. And then hawk watch sites. There are several of them in Michigan.
I've not heard of such a thing.
Yeah, so there are places where the hawks are counted. We call that a hawk watch. There'll be professional birders there counting the number of birds that are traveling across that area. And they tend to be areas where the hawks form these large kettles and are, you know, moving through. And so most of the hawk watchers are also very good at sharing information. And as long as you're not interfering with their counting, they'll point out stuff. And so even though you may not know what's going on, if there's, you know, there might be 100 broad-winged hawks in a kettle and one golden eagle, and they'll be glad to point it out. Those are good spots. Along the Detroit River is a good spot. Thousands of broad-winged hawks migrate through there. And Point Mouillet State Game Area, that's a big stopover for waterfowl.
And where's that?
Later. That's sort of central in the state, Bay City area.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are events that are planned in the fall, like there were in the spring. One of those events is called the Big Sit, or the Big Stay, as some people call it. And basically, you have a 17-foot circle that you have to stay in, and whatever birds that you can count in your yard or wherever you are, in up to a 24-hour period. Now, a lot of people will just do it for a half hour or an hour for fun, but the serious ones will spend a day at one location and report what they've seen, what's going through, or staying. So that's one event.
We talked about the citizen scientists.
Yes.
And how they can contribute and give information. Is the Big Sit part of that?
Yes, and anybody can do that and then submit your data. So that works well. The Detroit River International Wildlife Refuge and Detroit Metro Park, they host a festival of hawks at different times during the fall, usually in September.
Maybe I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, check your local area for, you know, or Google hawk watches in Michigan, and you can get some dates and times. Less popular than the spring are the warblers. We've already mentioned they're difficult to ID, but local warbler weekends happen at various nature centers and places. It's a challenge, but it's a fun way of doing it. And then bird banding stations, like at Whitefish Point and others, they're gathering.
That's in the UP, right?
The one in Whitefish Point is in the UP, yes.
Eastern UP along Lake Superior.
Right up at the very point there, yes. And they're doing research, but depending on the organization that's doing the banding, they'll often allow public in at certain times to see what they're doing. They like to share the conservation efforts that they're involved in. And then other count sites besides just the hawks, waterfowl are often counted. So like at Whitefish Point, we were just talking about, there's a big fall waterfowl count, and there's some poor person stuck in a little shack out on the point in the wind and cold rain all the way through November. It can be very miserable, but they're counting every bird that's flying over. And it's quite a feat that they do, but it gives us a lot of useful information.
I just kind of imagine somebody come up and say, are you enjoying this yet?
They'll probably say yes, even though they're cold and shivering, because they're there for a reason, and they believe in what they're doing. But, boy, the conditions can be miserable sometimes.
Is there that ice and snow temperatures yet?
Or? Yes, some, you know, early wet snow storms, but, you know, just those when driving rain, you're out there all day, and wind off of Lake Superior, it's they have a little 4x4 foot little shed that looks like an outhouse. But it's cabled down on all four corners because it would blow away in the storm. So it can be a challenge sometimes. But if the birds are there, they want to be able to count them.
Absolutely. Let's talk about conservation and the challenges.
Sure. So habitat loss is always comes up. And it's the same in fall migration. Places they used to stop now have been turned into a city or whatever. And so the birds are always having to adjust their migration patterns. And then you add to that, you know, changing climates, more severe storms, storms later or earlier, whatever. All of these things we're hearing in the news all the time that are happening. It's not just affecting humans and their lifestyle. It's also affecting the birds and their migration. So, you know, climate, you know, their instincts are built around certain times and safe times. And if that's all changing, that's tough. And so, our human-made changes are having an effect. Another one that people don't really think about too often is our cities, these tall glass buildings. Mm-hmm. So these birds are flying through at night following the stars, and then thump, they hit a window of a skyscraper.
And people have tried to do things to mitigate
yes,
that.
Yes, you know, you put up silhoettes of birds of prey and things like that. But, you know, again, the nighttime travel, that's difficult.
Do they, some buildings, they leave lights on to
that? Yeah, that's another whole issue is the light created by cities, the light pollution, makes it harder to see the stars.
Oh,
we know that, but the birds also have the same thing. Like, I didn't even know those stars were there when you get out on a clear night. And so there's a lot of places that are actually trying to reduce the amount of light pollution so the birds can see the stars so they can do their normal migration. So
we're coming back into the last minute or so. Mm-hmm. How do we kind of want to wrap this up? Any thoughts for our listeners? How can they get engaged?
Finding out what fall festival is going on and getting out and participating. And you don't have to know anything about birds to go do that. Most of these organizations are very happy to have someone who doesn't know anything or knows a lot. Whatever your knowledge base, they're eager to share and allow you to enjoy the experience.
What I hear you is just show up.
Showing up. Yeah. Find out what's close by and learn, and then go to the next place the next time and just keep learning. There's so much out there to learn.
And give our listeners the search terms they're looking for.
If you Hawkwatch for the birds of prey,
Hawkwatch,
or just birding events, and you go to any of your nature centers and just look to see what they've got. In fact, you know, it's not just birds; it's not just migration. There's just so many great things to do outside. You know, find your local conservation areas, your local parks, and see what programs they have to offer, and find something that's interesting to you.
Very good. Well, listeners, you've been listening to The Nature Guy, Dr. Gordon Atkins from Camp Asabo. He's also adjunct with Andrews University. And we just appreciate not only the fall, but the spring, where there's going to be another edition. We're going to talk about fish migration. Stay tuned. Until next time, I'm your host, Tom Azure, for Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.